Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
Hi, this is John Christopher, and welcome back to Real Life. Today I have as my guest, I'm so happy to have her, is Chris Tice, who is the Senior Managing Director of Corcoran in Sag Harbor and also in Montauk, correct?
That's right.
Yeah, Chris, it's great to have you here. I'm actually constantly fascinated by the journeys we take to get to where we are. So Before we talk about real estate, tell us about your journey. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Yonkers, which is north of New York City. Mm-hmm. You know, modest upbringing. My dad was a public school teacher and three other siblings. But I had a very idyllic childhood in the 60s and 70s where, you know, no electronic devices and kid plays outside. And, you know, it was fully engaged.
You didn't have to worry about being snatched or something, taken away.
No, although at times I'm sure my brother wished that happened.
I think all siblings think that sometimes.
I had a great childhood, and one of the best parts of it was that my dad, being a public school teacher, he had the summers off. And, you know, when we were young, he asked a colleague, where can I bring four kids where there's a beach and it doesn't cost a lot of money? And the answer was Sag Harbor.
You're kidding.
So we spent our first summer in Sag Harbor in 1964. And it was very different back then. The whole Hamptons were different, but particularly Sag Harbor. And so we grew up spending, you know, 10, 11 weeks every summer there.
Was it safe to walk down the streets of Sag Harbor then? Because wasn't the Black Buoy and those type of...
I never went into any of those establishments.
She says tongue-in-cheek.
It was very different. It was, you know, it was a very much of a working class town. And you really didn't see many families vacationing there in the summer. If they did, they probably had modest means. So it was a time of inexpensive restaurants, no galleries. You know, the big event was softball at the park where all the families gathered and watched the dads play. So I think my dad was on Suburban Sanitation's team and some other team another time. And we grew up with a lot of local families. It was wonderful.
How cool
is that?
It was
a wonderful way to grow up.
So where did you go for the water? Did you go to Long Beach or did you go to the ocean?
Sag, Maine. You could set your clock and still can by when my folks go. But we would go and it was, you know, 10 to 4 every day all summer.
Wow.
Needless to say, that was a time before real suntan lotion.
Was
it was like baby oil and reflectors, and I'm sure my dermatologist would be sending their kids to college off of my skin.
Oh, I'm sure.
But it was a great way to grow up, and I still have, you know, close friends that I knew growing up out here from the summer.
So was your dad like one of the mentors in your life, or did you have other mentors that guided you?
I had different mentors in different times of my life. Certainly, both my parents have been mentors in just the way that I think they treat people out of respect and the way they raised us. And we have a very close family. We make, you know, family time a priority. And so I was very fortunate to grow up in that household. But when I started out in magazine publishing, I worked for two very, very strong market leaders. And throughout my career there, before I got into the internet business, I had mentors. And then I shifted, you know, then there's real estate afterwards. But yeah. And, I, you know, one of the things that I tell my own kids and I tell agents that I'm mentoring is look for mentors everywhere because you can learn something from a lot of different people. You know, it's not usually one person that teaches you everything you need to know, but be inquisitive, be open, and look to learn wherever you are.
That's a fabulous piece of advice. So let's talk a little real estate. It's hard to imagine that we're already into the season. So Do you think the season's going to be any different from what it was a year ago?
It's hard to tell right now. We've seen, at least at Corcoran, that there's been a little bit of a lift in the rentals. But it's hard to know if more people are just coming back and working with real estate companies versus going direct. We saw a shift to more Airbnb and HomeAway, and I think both tenants and landlords have had some bad experiences, so we've had many come back to us. We're hoping that it's a robust season out here for the summer. And then in terms of sales, we've certainly, we're having a good year. So overall, we're not seeing, you know, a shift in any other direction.
Oh, that's fabulous. Now, it's interesting that you mentioned the rental market, because I've spoken to some agents who disparage, I guess, Airbnb and VRBO and HomeAway because, as one agent said to me, they're eating our lunch. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's any merit to what they say?
It certainly has had an impact. It used to be that most renters would go the full season, and then they may do July or July and August, and now we're seeing shorter term rentals. So that's frustrating to a lot of homeowners because they used to have their house rented the entire time, and now they're it's almost like they're running a boutique hotel. So it certainly has had an impact, but we have seen a swinging back because when you think about it, most of the homes out here are second homes, and it's a huge investment. It's one of the top assets that that individual has. And to work with an agent who is meeting that tenant and can make sure that it's a good fit and follow up during the season is really protecting that asset for that homeowner. So we have seen the pendulum start to swing in that direction.
So there's more or less, would you say, a vetting process that takes place with the agent as compared to, say, going to Airbnb?
Well, certainly, because through Airbnb, most of the times the homeowner doesn't even meet the tenant, particularly out here where most homeowners actually aren't resident here year round.
Right.
So there's a lot of value add that an agent adds in the rental process.
Now, let me ask you a question about areas. Now, at one point, Montauk was very robust. I don't know if it still is because you handle an office out there also. But the Sag Harbor, you know, they're saying that's what's happening in Sag Harbor. Let me ask you that question. Do you think we're still carrying the torch?
Well, Sag Harbor is as hot as ever. And I think part of that is because unlike most of the other villages, Sag Harbor has a main street that almost door to door is open at night, whether it's restaurants or galleries. It's really become a hub and a destination. There's very few other places east of the canal where you can park your car and dine and see theater and go into a gallery and not have to get into your car to the end of the night. So, there's some exciting new places opening this summer as well, but no matter what you want to do in the evening, chances are you can find it in Sag Harbor.
Yeah, as compared to, say, Southampton, a lot of times you go into Southampton at night and it's pretty dead.
Right, and Same thing with East Hampton. And for both of those villages, a lot of your restaurants that become destinations aren't even on Main Street. And so you don't have that excitement and that, you know.
Right.
And what they do in Sag Harbor, which is smart, is so many of the shops, particularly in season during the summer, stay open late because you have all that foot traffic. So it creates this kind of Faneuil Hall market feeling where there's just a lot going on.
So do you think it's a good time to buy or sell, especially in the Sag Harbor market?
I always think it's a good time to buy and sell. Look, the Hamptons are always going to be, I think, a destination that people want to be in. We've got the most beautiful beaches. In fact, I think a report came out yesterday of the top beaches in the country. Dr. Beach.
Right.
And two of the top, I don't know, it was 9 or 10, are right here in the Hamptons. So we have spectacular beaches, fabulous food, great entertainment. And it's just a wonderful place to be. So I don't think that's ever going to be diminished.
I think you're right. It's kind of interesting. Talk about wanting a job that I'd like to have Mr. Beach's job.
He goes around. Yes, absolutely.
So how can somebody get in touch with you, Chris, if they want to get some more information?
Well, they certainly can get in touch by emailing me. That's chris.tice@corcoran.com. Or giving me a call on my cell, 516-996-4174.
Fantastic. Chris, it's been a delight having you on the program. This is John Christopher for Real Life on the only NPR station on Long Island, WPPB. And we'll be right back with our next guest after this short break, Dr. Anthony Caruso of Southampton Dental Arts. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher. And today I have as my guest, Dr. Anthony Caruso from the Southampton Dental Arts. Anthony, how are you today?
I'm doing great.
Great. Anthony, you've been on the program before, and we've talked about the Hamptons and how long you've been out here and the changes that have taken place. But we ran out of time because there was a subject I did want to get to, and that's, to me, is relatively new as an advancement in dental care. And that's tooth replacements. Who came up with that idea?
Oh, great question. Dental implants are definitely on the forefront of technology today. But believe it or not, way back in 600 AD, the Mayans were actually coined for inventing dental implants. And this is very rudimentary, but they use seashells.
Is this when their heads were still on their bodies at that point?
I hope so. Gosh. That would help, wouldn't it?
Right. I mean,
for sure. But they, believe it or not, use seashells. When a tooth was lost, they'd replace it with a seashell. So, I mean, I don't know. That's a bit of a stretch, but, you know, all of, you know, my studies have pointed to that. But getting back to the real roots, there was a fellow, a European fellow by the name of Dr. Brandemark, who was the one who invented dental implants and really came up with the guidelines and what implants are all about. And basically back in the 50s, we started using titanium alloy screws, just like if you were to have your knee replaced, if you were to have a hip surgery, et cetera, et cetera. Same type of hardware, obviously modified for dental use. And so he came up with the idea of placing this in live bone, and it worked very favorably. In 1982, the FDA came up with guidelines with dental implants. So now dentists and surgeons would be placing, well, more surgeons at that point, because they were very in the very early stages in the 70s and the early 80s with implants. We actually started by placing what's called blade implants, and we'd open up the jaw a little bit, split the jaw, and we'd place this type of blade structure with a tooth sticking out. And then we got into more screw-based implants, which mimic the same shape and structure of a tooth root, and they work really, really well. Tried and true, they have a 98% give or take success ratio. And like I said before, they're made out of titanium. It's actually an alloy to be made stronger. And the process that's really important and is the basis behind dental implants is something called osseointegration. And that's basically where the threads of the screw and the bone cells become one. So now you have a tooth that's integrated into the bone.
The jaw.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a great procedure. I'd love to, you know, to talk more about it with you.
Yeah, sure. Well, let me ask you a question. How long will this implant last? I mean, someone goes through the process.
Sure. Great question. I mean, everybody wants longevity, especially in the dental office. I mean, we don't want to go through this big procedure and then find out 2 years later it's not going to work. Well, anything in the mouth is always dependent on how good the oral hygiene of the patient is. So if the patient is doing a really diligent job cleaning, basically an implant could last forever.
Wow.
They're impervious to cavities. It's titanium. You can't get a cavity. Going back to root canals from our last talk, you don't need a root canal on a titanium implant ever. So they're really a great form of dental therapy.
Do they? Do you take out the nerve in the process?
Good question. When you need an implant, the root of the tooth is completely gone. You know, you just have a space there. You have an empty bone area, and I'll give you just a quick rundown of how the surgery would go. We do it in the office. I was trained in a 1 year residency, and then I did a 1 year fellowship in implant surgery, and we'll get the patient numb. This is all done locally in the office. It's under an hour, usually half an hour. The patient can do whatever they want the next day. Mild discomfort, nothing more than Tylenol Advil for pain. We get the patient numb. We drill a teeny hole, make it slightly larger, place this titanium body screw in, cover up the area, close everything, and we're done. Very simple.
It.
Yes. Now, actually, a dental implant is made of three components. There's the screw that goes into the bone, there's the connector or the abutment, and then the crown that goes on top of it. So remember what we're getting back to is that osseointegration, mm-hmm. where the bone grows in around the implant. Well, that's a time period, and that really takes about 16 weeks or 4 months to heal, where the body, that becomes part of the body.
Okay. So in that process, then, I come into your office, you put the screw into my jaw, and then I go home, and now I have to wait the 16 weeks before I come back to see you again?
Yes, unfortunately. There are some advertisements out there, and you know about advertisements. And,
right, I've seen that.
There's all kinds of crazy things going on. One day you can have a tooth. That is plausible in very few cases. Maybe 5-10% of people who have perfect bone, and we won't fully load the implant. We'll actually make a temporary crown, and it's usually on a one-piece implant, which, again, has limited indications. But this is not for everyone. Every single patient is different from the next. So what's applicable with one person could be totally different with another.
So what happens in that time frame of 16 weeks? Is there a space between the teeth?
Well, you can leave it the way it is. For a lot of people, that's fine. Or we can make you
can
something.
Can you chew? I mean, is it?
Oh, absolutely. Within a week, the area is feeling much better.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be going back and chewing everything normally. We can make you a tooth that out of plastic or acrylic or something like that that can go into that space. Or a lot of people just live without it. You know, and
right.
It's usually a back tooth. Every once in a while, it's a front tooth, and we have to do something more aesthetically. But there's always a solution for that.
Yeah. So after 16 weeks, then you do the final process with the putting the crown on it?
Yes, we make a custom abutment, which screws into the implant, because the implant is a screw, but it's also hollowed out internally, and it's hexed and threaded. So we screw something into the implant called an abutment, and then a crown that is cemented or screwed into place. And it's just like your regular tooth. You can floss it, you can brush it, and it's never sensitive because it doesn't have a nerve, and it never gets cavities, and again, it never needs that root canal. So,
oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really a great thing.
So just curiosity, is there like a price range on how much this?
It's all over. It really depends. I mean, a rough ballpark estimate, somewhere between $3,000 and $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that goes into that. That's including the crown usually. And it's a complicated surgery.
Right.
And we have to do our due diligence. We have to measure anatomy. You know, there's not something to be taken lightly. And
right.
Every practitioner, whether it's a specialist or a general dentist or a periodontist, the field is open to any well-trained dentist.
Oh, so you don't need you could be a dentist and do
yes,
this.
Yes, you could be a general dentist.
But you've taken special training, though.
I've taken special training and courses right. that have enabled me to have the knowledge in order to be able to place these. Absolutely.
A while back, there was a thing about fillings with the mercury. Is that any merit to that, that there's mercury in the...
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely, there is, but there's a big but there.
Okay.
There hasn't been any clinical proof that the mercury in fillings is causing any deleterious effects on humans.
Interesting.
So, but there's a lot of people, including myself, who are very natural and don't want to have silver, mercury, palladium, these different metals in your mouth, especially mercury because it's a neurotoxin.
I know your office is there on 27, almost like diagonal from the Hampton Chitney, but you must have a website, right?
Absolutely, sure do. Our website is shdentalarts.com. We'd love for you to come and visit.
Fantastic. Anthony, it's been a pleasure having you here.
This is John Christopher for Real Life, and we'll be right back with my next guest, Seth Kelly of Kelly Built Homes.
You're listening to 88.3 FM WPPB, Peconic Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Real Life, and this is John Christopher. And today as my guest, I have Seth Kelly of Kelly Built Construction Management. Hi, Seth. How are you today?
Good, John. How are you?
I'm doing great. Did you grow up out here in the Hamptons?
I did. We moved out here in 1979.
Okay.
From where? As a kid, from New Mexico, actually.
New Mexico.
Yeah.
Now, what prompted the change? I mean, that's quite a distance.
Well, my father grew up in New York, and back then, my uncle was doing construction out in Montauk.
And so he fell in love with
him? So my father came out, and they were working together out then.
Oh, and he fell in love with the area, or just said, this looks like a... potential for a little
yeah, I think they fell in love with the air. I mean,
right.
You know, especially back then. And,
oh, yeah.
You know,
jeez.
Things were hopping, so.
Right, right. Now, in your career, at one point, you were in the restaurant business. How did you get into that field?
I was living in New York. I was working in the field. I was tending bar in New York in the mid-90s. And I came back out here in, like, 1999 and met Jeff Resnick over at Sen and Pow and ran those restaurants for him for a couple of years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh. So you know Jesse also over there.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Yeah, the whole family.
Yeah.
Right. So you were running the business per se is from the management standpoint.
Yes.
Gotcha. So you never got into having your own restaurant?
No. You know, there was always the talk of it, but it was no.
No.
I'm glad I'm doing what I'm doing now.
So now, okay, so...
growing up, your father's in the construction business, obviously. He started Kelly Built. When did that happen? When was that? When did you said 70?
Well, he and my uncle were doing it for, you know, I guess it's going on 40 years now. So, and then in its current format, which is my father and I, we've been doing it together now for 13 years.
So is there anyone else in the family that's part of the business?
Mike, my uncle, is involved with it still, and that's it.
Okay. Yeah. Is there a philosophy that Kelly Built has?
Yeah, it's taking care of the client. I mean, we build custom homes, not spec. Mm-hmm. So, and
they're really the high end.
Yeah, it's on the high end side. Right. And it's the philosophy is taking care of the client and the right. client's needs, and also meeting their expectations and managing their expectations. And also at the end of the day, walking away from something that you're proud of.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now you've, these homes that you've built, they're quite substantial. Can you tell us about a few of them that you've built?
Yeah, we finished a project recently on Gin Lane in Southampton. It was done by Barnes Coy Architects.
Okay.
Bridge, and it's a very big custom home done in a sort of a French chateau style.
Interesting.
Yeah, a lot of limestone. But at the same time, some modern elements with it, you know, big windows, tall ceilings. It's a cool house. And then we've done
just curiosity, how many square feet would you say?
About 15,000.
Okay.
And we finished a beautiful modern project on the ocean in Bridgehampton.
Speaking of modern, is modern... Someone told me once that building modern is more difficult than building a traditional.
It is. You know, the joke is always that they invented crown molding to hide mistakes, and you don't have that in modern.
You know, so it all has to be
everything
exact.
Everything has to be exact. You know, there's no
fudging.
There is no fudging in modern. It's got to be right. And if it's not right, it shows immediately.
Let me ask this from the standpoint of building. There must be challenges all the time. What was your biggest challenge, do you think, you've run across?
Honestly, it's our biggest challenge typically is, you know, sometimes you come up with design elements that you are new or that are, you know, technically complicated and just making sure that all the pieces work. Because, you know, you can have design elements in a house that may take 10 different subcontractors to put together. So you're managing all of that, making sure everybody's doing what they're supposed to do in the time period that you need. And also everybody working together is probably our biggest challenge every day.
So it's coordinating these 10 different elements.
For one detail.
One detail. My goodness. Did you have any interesting or funny stories along the way in your career building? Is there anything that pops to your mind?
Well, we had...
No names, though.
No names. But, you know, it's always interesting to know that, you know, a lot of people, they can be very successful in business, but they don't really have any idea of what houses... Because a lot of people come from apartment back, you know, dwelling, or, you know, they don't have any idea of what it takes to build a house or how things work in those processes. Years ago, we had a guy, very nice guy, come out, and we had just framed and sheathed the house.
Right.
And that's where we were at, and the windows were in, but it was still sheathing. And he came out, and he was looking around, and he was like, who okayed this? You know, do we paint this? Like, what is, you know, the sheathing? He had no idea that the sheathing was going to be covered, you know,
right.
with something. He was like, what do? We paint this? Like, who, okay, you know, where's my architect? I'm going to strangle him. You know, like, right. I had no idea that was the next
step
in the process.
Right. And, you know, that is funny.
You know,
so he didn't freak out. He just thought, how do we deal with it?
Yeah.
Now, speaking of architects, have you ever dealt with any architects, again, no names, that you think to yourself, what was he thinking?
No, not necessarily. I mean, in the custom industry and on the high end like this, there is a massive interaction every day between the architect, the interior designer, the client, us, subcontractors, in how these details get produced, how they, you know, they work, because a lot of the stuff on this scale is sort of designed as you go. It's very fluid, the process. So there's a lot of discussions back and forth about how the details work. Should they work this way? We'll put samples together for staircases and, you know, to make sure that those details look correct and more.
When you say samples, would they be on a smaller scale or?
Well, like we're doing a staircase right now in a house that we're building that we've built a mock-up, a full-scale mock-up of the staircase, a section of it, but a full scale, and looking how the details work in conjunction with each of them. And as a result of that mock-up, a lot of details changed because they didn't like the way it looked in actual real life. So
looking at the plans per se, or even the CAD, it's not quite the same as seeing the actual thing.
Well, it's hard for a lot of clients to get a real full picture of what something's going to look like from plans, because it's not an easy thing to do to visualize that. So what happens is that when you start putting stuff together, you always have changes because they're like, well, you know, I like the way that looks now that I see it, or let's change this, or let's do that. So, but we work with professionals, and they're usually there doing the scale of a house because they're good at the details.
Right, right.
So,
but that's kind of, is that common for you many times, is to do a mock-up so that the owner can get a feel of what
it
is?
Yeah, we'll do a mock-up of the siding with the windows so they can see how that looks, and, you know, stain samples, and we'll put glass next to, you know, the
wood. So the client's pretty much involved in the process along with
this,
you guys.
On this level, yes, because it's their project.
Right.
It's not a spec house. It's not they're just coming in and saying, okay, yeah, we like this and we're done it. This is, they're involved in every step of the way.
Wow. You must have a website.
It's kellybuilt.com.
Fantastic. Seth, it's been a delight having you on the program.
This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to peconicpublicbroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon, and have a safe journey.
You've been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people about the places and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, associate broker with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch. Theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com.